Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting Sherlock Holmes, The Final Adventure, Where Murder Is Elementary. Information at bard.org.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I have with me on the line from Utah County, Tom Bettis. He's USU's Extension Horticulture Agent with Utah County. And we're going to take a look at what you do when you go into the store and you see these great plants in the fall that look like they're on a great sale, but maybe they're not so great to get. And I know, Tom, for me, sometimes getting those plants is just a little bit of an impulse buy. Because in my case, I'm always looking for native and drought-tolerant plants. And so I kind of know what I'm looking for, but sometimes maybe I'm not so much. So what's the first thing someone should be doing before they even go out looking for plants?
Well, they need to know what their needs for their yard. And, you know, if you want to do some investigation trips to the garden center without knowing much and write a few things down, that's fine. But you have to know your yard, the needs for the area, to whether, you know, you need something drought tolerant or water tolerant, how big you want it to get, what kind of soil you have, and the light exposure. Because you go into a garden center, and at best, it'll have a little tag saying, grows this tall, and beautiful spring flowers, and that's about it. And our tendencies are to just like, oh, that looks cute, let's get it. And that's the last thing we should be doing.
So we should be looking at the tag first, not necessarily what the plant looks like.
Correct. And we also need to know the needs in our yard of what we have, where we need to plant things, so that we can go and say, okay, I've got a partial shade that is a little bit dry, and I need something about 4 feet tall. If you can bring that information with you, and even if you don't know a lot about the plants, there's usually a garden center employee, or you can use your smartphone to look up, if you're careful, where you get your information, more about the plant so that you know what you're getting into, so you don't have to dig it out a few years down the road because it isn't performing like you would like.
Why are there still plants available to purchase that growers have? What keeps them there? Why haven't they been purchased?
Well, there's several reasons. One is that even though the spring is the big time to put plants into the yard, that's when we get spring fever, we have needs throughout the summer. You know, people move to a different house, they might do some re-landscaping, they might decide they need a tree. And so there's enough of a market for many of these plants that they are stocked throughout the entire growing season. And then the other portion is that, especially the larger garden centers, you know, commercial construction goes on 12 months out of the year, and as long as there's not snow on the ground, the landscapers are putting plants in.
What should you be looking for? I know sometimes, especially the big box stores and not necessarily the local stores, tend to have plants that really aren't adapted to our areas, and maybe that's one of the things
don't.
To look for.
They will have a regional buyer that may be in charge of anywhere from 5 to 11, you know, states. And they have to try to come up with a plant mix that will best match their region. And the Intermountain West is so unique that oftentimes we get lumped in with a Pacific Northwest plant mix, and you oftentimes will see trees and shrubs shipped in here that may not be adapted to our alkaline soils. They may not even be cold hardy. They may want a lot more humidity than we have. And so especially when you're shopping at a box store, you must know what that plant is, because it may be very adapted to Portland, but not so Logan or Salt Lake City or anywhere else in the state.
What sorts of plants do you tend to see that fall into that category that people should avoid?
Well, some of the more desired ones include sugar maples, actual red maple. It's one of the trees that turn red in the fall in the Northeast. Silver maple is another one, autumn blaze maple, dogwood trees. Now, the dogwood shrubs will do fine here, but the dogwood trees, rhododendrons and azaleas are among the most common.
And it's just crazy because in the store, it may look like a really lovely plant, but it's how they've been taken care of in the store, and it's once it hits your soil, that's where the problems begin.
It is, and the problems may not show up for 3 or 4 months or sometimes even a few years down the road until some of those nutrient stores get depleted in the roots and you'll really run into problems. And you know, oftentimes I hear, oh, well, I'll just take care of it or I'll just supplement the soil. But doing that with a plant is almost like having a hot tub to where it requires regular maintenance and you have to spend money to where you could have had something very beautiful that you water once in a while and otherwise can just walk away and let the plant grow because it's adapted to the area.
What should you be looking for when you see these plants? And if you're like me, you walk in and it's like, oh, they've got them 50% off. What should you be looking for?
Well, anytime I see a plant for 50% off, red flags start going because sometimes they've been at the garden center or the box store too long and they may be root bound in the pot. So I always try to check the pots to see if I can get the bucket off and see if I have a lot of spiraling roots.
Is that as much of a problem with perennial herbaceous plants?
Not as much, more trees and shrubs.
Okay.
So the perennials seem to move a little bit more quickly.
So if you pull them out and you see that the roots have begun to spiral around inside, that would be one to avoid.
It would be, or if you absolutely have to have it because it's the only one, you will need to get a razor blade or a sharp knife and cut the roots on 3 or 4 sides, just a quarter of an inch or so in, so that you can reduce the chances that those roots will continue to spiral. That will, one, make the plant less drought hardy, and two, it could actually choke it by girdling the trunk 10 or 15 years down the road.
And so this is,
if it's not remedied.
I think this is a really important point. So if you don't cut those, even though you take them out and put them into the soil, they just continue to spiral around on themselves?
They do. Some of them can go out in search of nutrients, but a lot of those roots that spiraled will continue to do so, and they will choke the actual crown of the plant so that over time, it's in essence, you tied a rope right at that crown, and as the tree grew, you choked it.
I hear that maples are kind of notorious for that.
Maples and lindens are both infamously notorious for that. You can get a beautiful linden, and all of a sudden, 15 years after it's been in the ground, it just starts to decline, and then you have to dig it and find that girdling root and chop it out, or else it'll kill the tree.
So when you look and find herbaceous plants, what should you be looking for?
Herbaceous plants, I more look for, are they adapted to our climate, and do they fit the need of where I'm going to plant them? Because herbaceous plants just will not last as long as in a pot as summer woody plants, there's less chance of those being root bound. And so what I look for is, one, have I done my research? If I've got a hot area that doesn't get a lot of water, I might look for something like Gallardia, or down here in Provo, whirling butterflies. There's several natives that do well, that are beautiful perennials that bloom for a long period of time. And if you're searching for those, you may have to go to a garden center, an independent that specializes a little bit, because the box stores usually won't have some of the, I won't call them less common, but maybe just slightly harder to find native stuff that are just gorgeous in the landscape.
So would it be worth it to purchase a perennial plant that's pennies on the dollar and try and rehabilitate it? If it looks like it's got a little bit of green in there, I mean, I have my mother's penchant for trying to fix every plant I have. So is it worth trying to do that?
If the plant's adapted to our climate and it's still half alive, I might try to revive it because you oftentimes can. But if it's something, along the lines of a canna lily or some of the half-hardy sage plants or something, then I wouldn't bother because they're going to be problems. But if you know it does well here, if it's your situation, then by all means, plant that and see if you can restore it. Because on a perennial, say only half of it lives, that half will still regenerate into a nice plant. It's not like a tree.
I'm thinking of some flax plants that I saw languishing in a garden center, and three of them weren't looking all that great. One was a little bit worse than the other two. So I still bought all three of them because it was a great bargain, put them in, and the one didn't survive, but the other two did.
Yes, and you know, oftentimes on those perennials also, they do have a limited shelf life in that container. And if you can get them out, and again, you know, cut those roots, because they're herbaceous, the top dies back, you're not in nearly as much danger of any girdling. And sometimes they're actually fun to try to restore.
So the main issue is just do your homework before you go out and know what you need in your yard, and then make sure to look for that on the tag if it's available, and then just buyer beware.
It is. I mean, anytime you're discount shopping, a lot of times there's no warranty, and it is buyer beware, but if you know what you're doing and do a little bit of research, you can get some fabulous deals. You know, once in a while I'll see trees 70 or 80% off. I found fruit trees down here in Utah County for $7 each that were originally $30. I mean, there are some fabulous deals to be had, but it is buyer beware. And the other thing I can say is that as you're shopping at these garden centers, especially the independents, find a salesperson that knows what they're doing and is honest with you, because even though they might not sell you as much initially, you're going to return to them and buy more and have a better opinion of that garden center. And most garden centers will usually have a few people that have been there a long time, have a lot of practical experience, work with them. Don't go in on a Saturday when they're super busy. Go in on a morning and a weekday when they're less busy and get to know them and get to trust somebody, because they can also be a fabulous resource.
Great. Ton, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Ton Bettis is a USU Extension horticulture agent in Utah County, and we've been talking about what to do about those plants you find on sale in local stores and how to take care of them. Ton, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Right now, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll be back with the gardening calendar, and then I'll talk with Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist. We'll take your insect questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and leave your question or comment there. Stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to this portion of the Zesty Garden. In our gardening calendar, the Tahnequint Nature Center in St. George is hosting a Cooking with Homegrown Produce class. That's this Saturday, September 13th, from 10 to 11 a.m. Learn how to cook with zucchini and other veggies you're harvesting out of your garden. All workshops are free and open to the public. The Tahnequint Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. The Stokes Nature Center is featuring Backyard Harvest Forcing Bulbs on Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. at Anderson Seed and Garden, 69 West Center in Logan. Learn about planting fall bulbs and forcing bulbs to enjoy indoor winter blooms. This hour-long workshop will introduce you to a great selection of bulb containers. To register, go online at logannature.org. And then coming up next month, Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh is hosting their Hobby Greenhouse Series Friday, October 3rd, 10th, 17th, and 24th with Michael Caron and Brittany Hunter from USU Extension. Learn how to use a hobby greenhouse to grow vegetables and flowers beyond the freeze. This course discusses the different structures, building materials, heating and cooling equipment, supplies, growing schedules, plants, and pest management. Information is at thanksgivingpoint.org. And then in highlighting a gardener's market, Cedar City will host their year-round market. It's on Saturdays at 905 South Main Street in Cedar City. Well, I have with me in studio Diane Alston. She is USU's extension entomologist, and we're talking insects. And if you'd like to send us a question or comment, you can do that through zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there, or call us the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, we love those phone calls.
1-800-826-1495. I've got my phone with me. I guess we can take a text. In fact, I'm thinking about that, I should turn it off, at least the ringer, so it doesn't go off. 1-800-826-1495. Thanks for coming in, Diane.
Yeah, it's always fun. And I want to put a plea out to all those gardeners out there in Utah that are listening. And please let us know what questions you had about insect management this last summer, that things that perplexed you or or stymied you, please call in and or send an email or a Facebook
we
posting,
want to talk to
whatever.
You.
Yeah, we want to hear from you.
Now, we did get a comment from Diana in Vernal. And this was from August 22nd, and I've purposely held this until you came in so you could address this. She said, "Hi, this year I had no squash bugs. Either not growing squash last year removed the local population, or the fact that my squash was surrounded by a lot of radishes and the bugs could not smell the squash over the radishes. Good thing I have neighbors to share the crooknecks with."
Yeah, so we were talking right before the show that, you know, both of those main factors she mentioned, not growing squash last year, kind of hiding her squash, in this case with radish, could be a contributing factor. It could also just be something about squash bug cycles in terms of, you know, populations weren't very heavy this year for reasons of overwinter factors that affected adult numbers that spent the winter in her local area last year, or some other factors. So, but, you know, we're always thankful when we have those kinds of years where we don't have big problems with a particular pest.
I noticed I didn't have any squash bugs this year either.
So yeah, and a lot of times when I'm on the show, you'll say, "Well, this year was hardly any codling moth." That's the worm in the apples and pears. You know, why is that? And I wish I could, you know, I had a simple answer to tell you.
You would be multimillionaire over and over if you had
if
all.
If I
those...
could figure out what to do about box elder bugs that are now plaguing my fruit trees, I feel like I could yeah I could be a millionaire. But you know, insects do go in cycles, or numbers of insect populations do go in cycles, and that is pretty typical. One of the main factors for that is, of course, environment. And so, you know, extra cold winter or dry winter or wet winter, whatever might be a factor, or the current growing season environment, but also their load of natural enemies. And we've talked about, I think the last time I was on, we talked a lot about biological control. And there's always predators and parasitoids, other insects that attack insects. And so over time, those populations will fluctuate, and they tend to increase and kind of suppress their main prey, and then they'll diminish, and then the squash bug will go back up again. So there's those kinds of factors too. It's very complex.
And then you're looking at diseases that could possibly mm-hmm. affect them.
Certainly.
The one that's coming to mind is what you've noticed with the European paper wasp.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a wing deformity issue.
Yeah.
We think it's a virus, although I haven't heard that it's actually been
identified
as a virus, but we suspect it's a virus that's causing that wing deformity. And so those adults, they survive, but they don't fly very well. They're hampered in their flight. And so they're just not as efficient, obviously. If you're a female and you've got to provision your eggs, your larvae, and your nest to help them grow, and you're not able to forage very efficiently, well, obviously you're not going to produce as many offspring.
We've had over this last summer, when I was early in the spring, probably early June anyway, I looked up into our maple tree and noticed that there was a bald-faced hornet nest being built. These are the ones that build those big lantern-shaped.
Yep.
And it was high enough in the tree, kind of on a weak branch, though, so I was a little concerned about it crashing down, but I just let it go.
Right. And so what's your observation?
Well, it got really big. Mm-hmm. It got really big, and I love having them around because I know they eat lots and lots of flies.
Mm-hmm. They're a big predator on insects.
So, but now I don't see any activity in the nest at all.
Well, so they're done, and they actually, and you could even take that. A lot of times if you wanted to retrieve a large bald-faced hornet nest like that as kind of like a little trophy or something to show your friends or put in a display, this now once the activity's done, that's the time to collect the nest because they're actually not in there anymore.
So where did they go?
So they overwinter as adults, and so those adults seek out protected places to spend the winter, and they don't stay in the nest.
Is it just the queen, or do they all...
So, yeah, it's only going to be it's females that have been mated, and so they're reproductively prepared for next year, and they don't need males to spend the winter. Yep.
All those workers, and now it's just empty, and they never reuse a nest, correct?
They don't. They always start over again. So this will be the time that people say, oh, can I take down the nest now? And yeah, once you're sure that there's no activity.
I think I'm going to jiggle the branch just a little bit to be sure.
I tend to wait till it's chilly, till there's a real chill in the air, and then you can be sure that they're done with the nest.
A neighbor 2 years ago invited me to pick their pears, and they were humongous, and I put the ladder in the tree, started climbing up, and I looked to my left when I was halfway up the ladder, and about 3 feet away was this humongous bald-faced hornet nest, and it was cold enough that they couldn't get to me. They were just kind of sort of lying around the nest, and I dodged a bullet on that one. So
that's good.
Yeah, I'll definitely make sure.
But you made a good point, which I want to make sure people do realize. They are a beneficial insect to have around, and most often they do build their nests pretty high, and so they're not directly impacting human activity below. But obviously if a nest is lower, under the eave of a house or someplace like that where it's going to be right in the way of where there's, human traffic, then, it may not be tolerable and you'll need to have it removed or remove it. But for the most part, they are beneficial. And I say, let them be. And as long as they're not bothering you, they'll be helping you out.
Why don't you talk about the trap for the European paper wasp, since they're out. I was in a neighbor's patch of raspberries, and he's like, oh, do you know how to get rid of these wasps? They're just drinking me out of house and home, meaning that they go to the berry and suck the juice out. And I said, I've got just the thing for you. So I sent him the link to how to build it's a cheap way to take care of them.
Trap. Mm-hmm. Right. So first, let me just step back a little bit, and we got to distinguish between the two main kinds of black and yellow paper wasps we see around this area. There is the yellow jacket, which actually has a little more yellow on it, and it's a more aggressive wasp, and its sting is quite
painful.
They're
the ones you usually see when you're outside trying to have a picnic.
Exactly, and they'll come, fly onto your plate while you're eating dinner outdoors, and they nest in the ground, or at least in contact with the ground. So that particular wasp, the yellow jacket, you can purchase in the grocery store or any kind of store that sells insect traps, a yellow plastic kind of trap that has a pheromone, a chemical in there that you put in as the bait. Okay, so that's yellow jacket. Then we have these European paper wasps, and these are the ones that are so abundant, bothering your friends' raspberries. And they are
my raspberries.
And your raspberries. They're very interesting. They like to eat fruit this time of year. They also are predators, and they will eat insects too, but they tend to do that more earlier in the summer. And this time of year, they're very focused on eating sweet fruit. And so that's the one that you can make. And that yellow jacket trap does not work for the European paper wasps. So that's an important point to make. A lot of people buy that trap at the store thinking, oh, I'm going to get all of these wasps. And they realize, oh, it's not actually getting the European paper wasp. So you want to make a homemade trap. And as you mentioned, we have a YouTube-style video on our Utah Pests, our USU Extension webpage. And it's very simple. You just use a plastic soda bottle. You can either go with the liter or the half liter, whichever size you want, and you just cut the bottle off right at the shoulder area, and then you'll invert that top end to be like a funnel down inside it. But you want to use a fruit juice based bait because that's what they're attracted to this time of year.
Slightly fermented.
And it's only one part fruit juice to 10 parts water. So it's a pretty dilute fruit juice. And then it's helpful to add a little yeast or a piece of ripe fruit that you might have around and stick it in there. And that will just accelerate that fermentation. And that's what you want because that's the odor that they're attracted to.
So the idea is you've inverted the top into the body of the container and they fly in.
Right.
But they can't get out.
And they have a hard time getting out. Another good thing to do is add a couple drops of liquid dish soap. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it makes a soap film on the surface of this liquid bait that you've made. And then when they fall, that they land on that because they want to drink this fermented fruit juice when they go down inside the trap, and then that breaks the surface tension and they fall in and they drown much faster than if they can, because they have the ability to kind of stand on a watery surface.
So have you built one of these traps?
Oh yes, I use them around my raspberries, my blackberries, my peaches.
Yep. And they work pretty well?
They do. They work quite well.
And do you see the populations down in your berries?
I feel like if you have to put, you know, a number of them out, and it's also good to start as soon as you start to see kind of more paper wasp activity. You know, this generally starts like more in July, maybe at least certainly by 1st of August, and that's a good time to start getting the traps out, because you want to be reducing the numbers over time. You know, they're not going to be magical. You know, if you've got a super high population, a lot of ripe fruit all at once, and you put a few traps out, you know, it's not going to just, you know, solve all your problems. The other important things to do are they do nest in often like in outbuilding sheds, under the eaves of homes, under wooden decks, that kind of location. And these are the nests that they build. They have the kind of they're the papery umbrella shape with the open cells hanging down. And so if you know where they're nesting around your yard, removing those nests is a good way to help reduce the population.
I know their populations are going down, at least in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. because they've always nested in the ends of our clothesline,
the poles,
supports,
yeah,
and
those metal poles.
And they're open on the ends, and
they
love that. But I haven't had any this year,
uh-huh.
and there's cobwebs that have formed in there. I'm like, okay, this is a good sign. I'm glad for
and,
that.
And if you know they nest in there and you're still having problems with that, you can just put something to cover the end of those.
Yeah, you stick tinfoil in there.
And then that way it keeps them out. But I agree with you. I don't see nearly as – I see them around my house, but I used to have a lot more a number of years back than I do now.
Oh, and my chicken coop used to be full of them, and now just a few here and there.
And a proportion of those that I do see, it may not be half, but it's at least – it's a good proportion, have that deformed wing problem. And so I suspect that pathogen is a big part of their population decline.
Okay, so when looking at this particular insect and how will they eventually overcome whatever it is that's attacking them? And then, like, are the stronger ones being left?
That can happen. It tends to generally form a balance. And actually, I didn't mention, but this European paper wasp, as the name suggests, is not native to this continent. And it was brought in inadvertently into North America. So we do have also native species of paper wasp there. Well, I mentioned the yellow jacket, which is a kind of paper wasp.
Yeah, what does the little teeny ones?
Well, there's some big ones. You mean the big ones?
Well, I've seen.
They're larger.
There's the big one that we just talked about, but then I've also seen little nests of paper that are only
there is a native species of paper wasp. Actually, the wasp itself is larger, but its nests are smaller. Interestingly, they don't I think maybe I'm not sure if more than one female nests together, maybe that's it, or fewer do. But they are also, they're an important predator, and generally they don't feed on fruit. They don't, you know, cause those kind of negative problems that we associate with the European paper wasp. So what we found when the European paper wasp first arrived is I hardly saw any of those native species, but now I'm seeing more of those. So my point was that I think things get back in balance, and so you say, will they ever be able to overcome this pathogen that's affecting their wings? Well, some individuals don't get it, obviously, and as they are, natural selection will play a role in those surviving, doing better, that aren't susceptible to the virus. But on the other hand, I think they will get into balance with the other species. There's this concept called a niche, which maybe you've heard about, which is how an individual, including humans, how we make a living. So what niche do we fill? Which resources do we use? Where do we live? Which foods do we eat? And so when you're in a balance level, you're each sharing, you know, whoever you're sharing that niche with, who uses the same resources as you or lives in the same kinds of places as you, you come into some level of balance. And certain things can upset that, you know, and then you might see it change in the future. But when you kind of settle back down into that balance, which is kind of where I think we are right now in northern Utah with the European paper wasp.
I think humans need to take a lesson from the insect world sometimes, because I don't think we've quite figured that out yet.
Right. We're always trying to exceed our niche, I think.
Mud daubers. I haven't seen any mud daubers for a while, but how are their populations doing?
So I do see them around where I live. They do have particular requirements. Obviously, they got to have good access to mud, and they like to build their nests also in protected places. I have these outdoor outlets on my patio that have those little like plastic doors on them, and you open them up and you stick your plug into the outlet there. And they love to get, because there's holes in the bottom where your cord can come out, and they love to fly up in there and make their nests in there. So I do see them around, and they are another kind. They're not a paper wasp, but they're related. And they also are a beneficial predatory insect and really not prone to sting unless they're, you know, being squished, kind of, you know, have to protect themselves. And so I do see them around, but they're not as abundant typically as the other paper wasps.
I usually see them either in my attic, because I have an exposed attic, and I'll see them along the corners of the beams, or out in my barn in the corners is where they tend to build. But they're fascinating to watch. And I think it was either the last one or the one before, Wild About Utah, there, that was all about mud daubers, and it was just kind of fascinating. So if you're interested in listening to that, go to the Utah Public Radio page and go to programs and then scroll down to Wild About Utah and listen to the latest one about mud daubers. It's really interesting.
So one other little interesting thing to add about those, I had one that was right in the corner of my porch, and most people might say, oh, that's a eyesore, and remove it. But I like natural things, so I thought it was kind of a cool thing. And when they were done that year, it was, you know, vacated. But it left, you know, the little mud blob with the holes in it. And so then I noticed the next year, all the leafcutter bees started using those little tubes, the little holes, as nests. And so then they were, you know, I could see they were capped off with little leaf cells. And then I've been, since then, there's been several generations, several years now of leafcutter bees that have used that, their nests. So I thought that was pretty cool.
They are fun to watch. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me in the studio is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we would love to talk to you at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. We only have about 7 minutes left in this portion of the program. 800-826-1495 to get your question in soon. Also, email is zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there. So I wanted to make sure that we talked about, you sent me some information about the varroa mite and how they know when to go from one hive to the next.
Right.
And I thought it was really quite interesting, and it makes me wonder why the bees just don't groom them off. But why don't you talk about this
yeah,
article?
So the varroa mite it's not a new pest to honeybees. It's been around for a while, but it's certainly one of the issues that's been implicated in this colony collapse disorder that has been so much in the news the last 5+ years with honeybee colonies declining. And this is a mite that is a parasite on honeybees. So it has a little teeny tiny mite, and it actually lives just on the back and the various parts of the honeybee. And they particularly like to feed on the larvae that are in the hive of the honeybee, because that's their favorite food, because they're these little grub-like things, and they don't have any self-defense, I guess, and they're pretty nutritious. They don't kill the bee outright, but they stress it, just like that's what parasites do. And so there's been some recent research that's just come out of Italy that I thought was really interesting. That's the story that I sent to you, where some researchers have been looking at how this varroa mite knows when it needs to move on to another hive, because either there's too many mites, it's, you know, exceeding its population potential, or it's the honeybees are not doing too well and they're starting to decline, and so they better go find, you know, a more vigorous hive to attack. And what they did was they found that when there's low levels of varroa mites in a hive, that the mites spend most of the mites, when they move on to a new bee, they pick what are called the nurse bees. And these are the bees that tend to stay in the hive and take care of the larvae. And that would be advantageous to the varroa mite to stay in the hive and get better access to the larvae, which they prefer to feed on. However, they found that when the populations of varroa mites creep up and start to get fairly high, the mites then start to move on to other kinds of bees as well. These are called the forager bees, the ones that go out looking for pollen. And so that might be then an advantage to the mite to get to move outside of the hive. And then that forager might actually visit another hive, and it could then hop off into a different hive and, you know, basically go exploring or expand its horizons. And so So the researchers were asking, how does this happen? How do the mites know? How do they know this? And so what they found is that there's a strong link, a very strong association between low or high mite populations in a beehive and the composition of the cuticular wax. So insects have their skeleton on the outside as opposed to like vertebrates that have it on the inside. And they have a waxy layer there that helps prevent water loss, because that's one of the big factors for insects. They got to survive, you know, being desiccated. And that cuticular wax actually changes whether it's low or high mite populations. They didn't explain that they know the mechanism yet of how that happens, but they do feel that that's what the mites, the varroa mites, are sensing, that cuticular wax composition and who they're going to hop a ride on, whether it's a nurse bee or a forager bee.
Now, why? I've never had thought of a forager bee going to another hive. Yeah, wouldn't it just be kicked out?
They do. A lot of times they're, they could be just curious and want to go explore, but there could also be reasons of why they're visiting another hive. Sometimes they even rob resources from other hives sometimes too. So,
well, I just would thought that the other bees would attack it and send it out, but apparently that's not so much.
They can have their little guard bees there at the entrance, and the forager might not make it in, but maybe they could drop off their mites onto the guard bees, and then that could be an access for the mite into the hive as well. But I just thought that was a really cool kind of biology story.
And in relation to that, it led me to another article your link did that talked about how some of the Africanized honeybees are less susceptible to the varroa mite.
So, and I guess that doesn't surprise me. We tend to see when there's pretty strong, like, behaviors or abilities of any kind of organism. In my case, I study insects, obviously. So in the case of the Africanized bee, it's a pretty aggressive bee. It's good at fighting off other bees, good at colonizing. It flies long distances, you know, can move into new areas, build new hives. So that's a strong attribute, but also then it carries this ability to also have resistance to varroa mites. So I think somebody definitely needs to be exploring that.
Maybe it just grooms itself better than the regular honeybees.
Yeah, we were talking about that also, that there's been research looking into more hygienic honeybees, the bees that groom themselves more, and that those tend to have less of these varroa mites and other pest problems.
This is really interesting. It sounds like a topic for another discussion.
Yes, lots to learn.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Diane, thanks for coming in.
It was always fun.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Diane Alston is USU's Extension Entomologist. Coming up next is Nancy Williams with Petals and Prose, and you're going to learn all about tomatoes, and she gives you a recipe for tomato pie that is now online at upr.org.
Sounds delicious.
So stay tuned.
Glad you're here with me today, because we're going to talk about that thing that is absolutely driving us all batty, although we love it this time of year, which is tomato explosions in our garden. My tomatoes are just going gangbusters out there, and they're all temperamental beauties. They're all heirlooms, and they're just not ever stopping, and they're fabulous. And so I look for things to do with them. And when I do that, I turn to one of my favorite authors, who wrote about food in More Home Cooking, subtitle, A Writer Returns to the Kitchen, and her name is Lori Colwin. She has a whole chapter on tomatoes, and I thought I would just share that with you today because it sings to my heart. So here we go. Lori writes, "There are very few things mankind can't live without. For centuries, we survived without compact discs, automated bank tellers, iceberg lettuce, and bubblegum-flavored toothpaste, to say nothing of the internal combustion engine. But life as we know it would be unimaginable without the tomato. Half of our soups, pasta sauces, and pizzas would vanish. No gazpacho, no ketchup. Our stews would lose their snap, our chili would fall flat. Every time you turn around, the tomato is giving its wonderful flavor to something. How empty our grocery shelves would be without pureed tomatoes. Tomato paste in cans and tubes, sun-dried tomatoes, tomato soup, tomato juice, and the imported crushed tomatoes that come in those little boxes. One of the joys of summer is to go roaming through your garden, pulling ripe tomatoes off the vine and biting in. juice and seeds drip all over your nice white shirt. But who cares? In summer, the idea is to eat as many tomatoes as you can and enjoy the luxury of getting sick of them. When September rolls around, they have become a little woolly and somewhat less flavorsome. Then it's time to lay in a big supply of canned tomatoes, store-bought or homemade, to take you through the winter. A world without tomatoes is like a string quartet without violins. My own idea of pure bliss is a tomato sandwich, which is good on any kind of bread, from grainy imported Vollkornbrot to suave, textureless semolina. This sandwich can only be made with ripe tomatoes, luscious and full of seeds. The bread is slathered with mayonnaise, then dusted with celery salt, and layered with thinly sliced tomatoes. I prefer this sandwich open, but it's fine with a lid. My favorite salad is the ubiquitous salad of the Middle East. Diced cucumber, onion, and tomato dressed with salt, pepper, olive oil, and lemon juice. If you fry up some squares of pita bread in olive oil and add some flat-leaf parsley and a little fresh mint, you have a salad called fatoche, which is ridiculously delicious and extremely simple to make. This salad, with or without bread, is my summer staple. I often make a large batch, eat it all for lunch myself, and then have to compose another batch for dinner. The tomato, summer and winter, is everyone's friend. The world's easiest and quickest pasta sauce can be made with fresh tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, or drained canned tomatoes, which you dice and sauté in olive oil with minced garlic and hot red pepper flakes. This takes less than 10 minutes and always tastes good. With freshly grated cheese, you can't ask for anything better. I've never yet encountered tomatoes in any form unloved by me. Often at night, I find myself ruminating about two previously mysterious tomato dishes, which I was brazen enough to get the recipes for. One is tomato pie, and it's a staple of a tea shop owned by Mary O'Brien in Salisbury, Connecticut. According to Mary, the original recipe was found in a cookbook put out by the nearby Hotchkiss School, but she has changed it sufficiently to claim it as her own. The pie has a double biscuit dough crust made by blending 2 cups of flour, 1 stick butter, 4 teaspoons baking powder, and approximately 3/4 cup of milk. Just a regular biscuit dough, either by hand or in a food processor. You roll out half the dough on a floured surface and line a 9-inch pie plate with it. Then you add the tomatoes. Mary makes this pie year-round and uses first-quality canned tomatoes, but at this time of the year, 2 pounds of peeled fresh tomatoes are fine, too. Drain well and slice thin 2 28-ounce cans of plum tomatoes. Then lay the slices over the crust and scatter them with chopped basil, chives, or scallions, depending on their availability and your mood. Then grate 1.5 cups of sharp cheddar cheese and sprinkle 1 cup of it on top of the tomatoes. Then over that, drizzle 1/2 cup of mayonnaise that's been thinned with 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, and top everything with the rest of the grated cheddar. Roll out the remaining biscuit dough, fit it over the filling, and pinch the edges of the dough together to seal them. Cut a few steam vents in the top crust and bake that pie at 400 degrees Fahrenheit for about 25 minutes. The secret of this pie, according to Mary, is to reheat it before serving, which, among other things, ensures that the cheese is soft and gooey. She usually bakes it early in the morning and then reheats it in the evening in a 350-degree oven until it's hot. It's hard to describe how delicious this is, especially on a hot day with a glass of magnificent iced tea in a beautiful setting, but it would doubtless be just as scrumptious on a cold day in your warm kitchen with a cup of coffee. The other tomato concoction has no name. I had it at a very fancy buffet as a side dish. Whatever it was, I tried not to disgrace myself by eating enormous quantities of it, but I was not very successful. I just couldn't get enough. Finally, I snagged a waiter and begged him to tell me what was in it. Apparently, you take numerous cans of plum tomatoes, drain the tomatoes, put them all into a large roasting pan, drizzle them with olive oil, and sprinkle them with chopped garlic. You then bake this in a moderate oven for a very long time. The waiter was unclear about how long, but he did say you had to stir it once every 30 minutes to get the brown parts mixed in with the rest. This might be a good thing to try on a winter's day when you have no intention of leaving the house and have invited a couple of worthy friends to come for dinner. It would also be heaven on a wet summer evening, served hot or cold. With a loaf of bread and a bean salad, this makes a dinner I would walk through fire for. My daughter has a book called Little Dog Dreaming, the story of a city dog who gets to go to the country for the summer and spends the winter lying on various chairs and sofas, dreaming and dreaming about the exact spot in which he has buried his bone. I spend my winter daydreaming about the exact bowl I am going to make my first summer tomato salad in, and about how I will not feel the slightest twinge of remorse if I buy the last two bags of tomatoes at the organic farm stand. A nicer person would leave a bag for someone else. I have been known to open one of those bags in the car and eat most of it without sharing on the way home. These are the sorts of deep, primitive feelings inspired by tomatoes, and I am convinced that there are millions of citizens out there just like me. On one of the great days of my life, a friend with an enormous garden invited me and a pal to wander through his tomato patch and take as many plump specimens as we wanted. It was the end of the summer, and he had overplanted. I felt like the person in the Andrew Marshall poem, The Garden, about whose head ripe apples fall, except that these were tomatoes. In this case, sharp, ripe, juicy cherry tomatoes. In this world of uncertainty and woe, one thing remains unchanged. Fresh, canned, pureed, dried, salted, sliced, and served with sugar and cream or pressed into juice, the tomato is reliable, friendly, and delicious. We would be nothing without it. And that is what Lori Colwin has to say about tomatoes. One of my favorite pieces of advice about keeping tomatoes came from Lynn Rosetto Casper when I met her, to my great good fortune, in southern Utah a few years ago. She's written a wonderful cookbook called How to Eat Supper, and she is the woman who does the UPR program Splendid Table. And she has written this about roasting vegetables. She was the one who told me the best thing to do with ripe tomatoes, if you had too many of them, was not to can them, but actually to roast them. And she told me how to do it. It sounded quite a lot like what Lori Colwin recommended. Lynn said you just take your biggest tomatoes, all different varieties, not stick with anything. You can just, you fill up a half sheet pan, which is the biggest sheet pan that you have that has edges. Put a little olive oil down on the bottom of it, and then just take slabs of your tomatoes, 3/4 to an inch thick, and lay them down, cram them in there. Sprinkle a little balsamic vinegar over the top and salt and pepper, and put them in a 450-degree oven. I usually set my timer for 30 minutes. Before the 30 minutes is up, your house is going to smell like a good Italian restaurant. But at the 30 minutes, if your tomatoes aren't too juicy, you need to check them before that, and you can kind of smell them. You want them to start caramelizing. You want the juice to get a little bit browned and caramelized around them, and then you stir them together. When you stir them together, then they're a beautiful paste. If you are not fond of seeds or little pieces of tomato skin in there, you can strain it when it's cool. I don't mind those, so I just leave it in there. When I stir them the first time, I kind of judge how much longer they need to roast. I snip a little fresh basil in there and put them back in to roast for another 10 or 15 minutes until they really are the consistency of a nice tomato sauce. And then I take it out, and when it cools down, I pop it into Ziploc bags and freeze it. It's a quick and wonderful thing to do. No canners are involved, and your house smells fabulous. What's not to like? So that really is what Lynn Rosetto Casper says about roasting vegetables. She calls it cooking by instinct. She says, basically, you can roast any vegetable, and all it's really all about your nose. First, you turn the oven on to 450 degrees. Slip a big shallow pan in to heat up with the oven. The pan should be large enough so the vegetables can be spread out. You don't want them over one layer deep. You can mix them up. The gold standard of shallow roasting pans is the heavy-duty half-sheet pan. Mix your vegetables by balancing earthy with sweet. For example, cauliflower and turnips with carrots, tart greens with parsnips, Brussels sprouts with yams. Generous amount of onion is essential. For even quicker cooking, thin slice the harder root vegetables like your potatoes. Toss the vegetables with good tasting oil and seasonings. Determine how spices and herbs will taste when mixed together by putting them on the tip of your tongue. If you don't like the mix, try something else. Some dependable combinations are sage, rosemary, and lemon zest, or allspice, cumin, coriander, and chili powder, or minced fresh ginger, soy sauce, and rice vinegar. You allow 30 to 40 minutes of roasting time for soft vegetables like zucchini, peppers, onions, tomatoes, and fruits. Root vegetables may need another 20 or 30 minutes. And you turn those vegetables two or three times during cooking. Use a wooden spatula to scrape up the brown glaze that collects on the bottom of the pan. This is pure flavor, so keep blending it back into the mix. Remember, a few caveats here. If you're using garlic, garlic burns in longer cooking roasts, so add it to the last half hour. Sweet sauces like barbecue ones burn within minutes, so it's best to add them during the last 15 minutes. Vinegar, citrus, and other acids slow down browning. When you use them as seasonings, you may need to brown the vegetables at the end of the cooking by slipping them under the broiler for a few minutes. That's all the best advice I know about roasting vegetables. And roasting vegetables, as I said, is my favorite way to keep tomatoes over the winter. If you would like to see the recipe for tomato pie from Lori Colwin, it will be on the UPR website for the Zesty Garden. Thanks for listening to me, and I'll see you next time. This is Nancy Williams for the Zesty Garden.